the why question is only of importance to me when a case begins, so it can lead me to who. You know, if I know the why, I can find who. Once I have who, I no longer care about why. But in every instance, there is a trigger. There is something that sets this ball of violence in motion. And that's what's intriguing to me. How did this actually begin? You know, where did it actually start? You know, there was a famous case here recently where a guy killed a 17-year-old boy, black kid, in, I think it was Georgia somewhere, then the South. And he said he was a security guard, which he was not. He said he was in neighborhood watch, which he sort of kind of was, but he was kind of self-appointed neighborhood watch guy. And he had been talking to the police on numerous occasions about suspicious people in his neighborhood. They were familiar with him, and they were concerned about him. They thought he was a loose cannon. And so the night that that shooting occurred, he called the police and said he has seized this 17-year-old black male acting in a suspicious manner, whatever that means, in his neighborhood. The police department said, do not approach him. Do not get out of your car. We will send an officer. So what does he do next? He gets out of his car. He was told not to. He approaches the kid. He was told not to. What happens then? He shoots the kid to death. Now, how did that start? It started by willful act of his. That's what set that whole thing in motion. Not what that kid was doing. Not where he was. Nothing. Mr. Wizard in the car is why that kid's dead. That's the interesting part of what begins this. How does it start? Because everything has a beginning.
At the top of the show, you heard the host of American Detective on Discovery Plus, Joe Kender. Joe's new book, Killer Triggers, is now available from Blackstone Publishing. In American Detective, Kender trades in his own case files from his previous show, Homicide Hunter, to bring viewers investigations from around the country. Each episode features a different homicide detective whose tireless efforts help put a killer behind bars. I'm Gregory Day. You're listening to an ad-free episode of The Portland Podcast. Joe's new book, Killer Triggers, explores the many triggers of homicide, such as fear, rage, revenge, money, lust, and sheer madness. The book is a follow-up to his previous bestseller, I Will Find You. Let's hear more now from Joe on his latest release, Killer Triggers.
May I speak to Gregory Day, please?
Oh, hello, sir. Wow, that is great to connect with you. Wonderful.
No, it's Kenda. I assume you guessed that.
Yes, right? yes. I love that humility.
Oh, hey, it's just me, man, you know?
Right. The homicide hunter.
I'm the same guy I've always been. I've been shocked by the notoriety this has provided. Right. I really have, but it has. Okay, that's fine, but it's very weird. It's still weird. It's been 9 years, 10 years, you know?
And you're a best-selling author now, too.
I am. Yeah. Pretty remarkable.
Yeah.
Everything has been remarkable, Gregory. You know, but whatever. It's the reality. You know, people like to hear about things they don't understand, and homicide is something they don't understand.
Yeah. Well, I've gathered a much better understanding from reading both your books. You've written two books now.
I have, yeah.
I actually listened to both your interviews with Chris Hardwick, too, and you mentioned, it was sort of an offhand comment, that you read a lot. You read a lot in your off time. I'm curious what you do. Do you read fiction? Do you like the escapism or nonfiction?
No, I read historical works. Probably the best thing I've read lately is there's two books on the role of the U.S. Navy in the Pacific in World War II.
Oh, really?
The writer, his name is Ian Toll, T-O-L-L. It's considered to be the definitive work because he reads and speaks Japanese And he also, of course, is English. But he wrote the first book is called Pacific Crucible. And it's like 600 pages. And the second book is called Conquering Tide, another 600 pages, where he describes the mindset of not only the American Navy, but the mindset of the Japanese. He spent 6 years in Tokyo researching Imperial War records and reading what the management of the Japanese Navy and the Japanese Army were considering as their methods of operation. It's a unique, there's one sentence in it that gives you a drift of what it was going to be in the first book. He writes this, he said, America was about to engage in something they had never seen, a war without mercy. And the Japanese made the Nazis look like schoolboys.
Oh, man.
All right. Wow. Oh, yeah. Oh, yes, indeed.
Was that information hard to find?
What information are you talking about?
From the Japanese archives.
It was he talked at great length about that. And when he wrote the bibliography, it was very, very difficult.
Yeah.
They were resistive of exposing it.
Exactly, yes.
In the first place. In the second place, they were highly restrictive on what he could see. But he spent so much time there, eventually they sort of gave up and just let him look at everything. You know,
right.
I think that's human nature. You know, they get tired of looking over someone's shoulder and say, well, he's not a bad guy. We'll just let him look at this stuff. You know? And that's what he did. So smart, really. You know, he became a fixture in their building and they started not paying attention to him. If you look like you belong, it's because you do, right?
Right, and you did that yourself when you were visiting
with
hospitals and sort of pretending to be a doctor.
Yeah, of course. I was a doctor. I didn't say I was a doctor. I just never said I wasn't one. When they said, good morning, doctor, I'd say, good morning. You know, that's all they would say. So,
well, this is wonderful.
If you look the part, you are the part. You know?
Yeah, exactly. I'm so thrilled that you wrote a second book because I enjoyed the first one so much. Chapter 9, I'd like to touch on. Chapter 9, I think it's the longest chapter in the book, and it has a very satisfying conclusion. This case went cold. If another detective was on this case, it probably would have never been solved. And you describe the conclusion of this case as being better than sex.
It was.
Would you like to touch on that?
It certainly was. There's a moment of euphoria that comes to you when the shadow in the night has a first, middle, and last name and a face. And you say, oh, you're not a shadow anymore. You happen to be you. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing better than that, really. When you spend that many years of your life and that many maddening moments trying to discover who's responsible for this crime for a victim that nobody particularly cared about.
True. Very true.
Which is the saddest part. You know, in my mind, it was the saddest thing because everyone has value. Everyone has a mother. Everyone has someone. And no one should be permitted to play God. You don't get to decide who lives and who dies. And particularly for a $40 boombox, come on, you know?
Yeah, ridiculous.
A violent homicide like that, good night. But you're talking about a violent person, okay? That's why humans are the most dangerous animal on this planet. Animals kill for need, humans kill for pleasure. Very frightening.
Another case that really stuck with me was the Limbrick case, Chuck Limbrick.
Chucky.
Yeah, I did a bit of digging on Chuck. There's videos of him out there, and he's so charismatic.
Of course.
And very convincing. And he managed to get out of a life sentence and get released. And boy, this had a very interesting twist you talk about in the book. But just his charisma was so striking, very striking. Mm. Seeing those videos is chilling because of how convincing he is.
Of course. I had another case where the guy's a serial killer. He's on death row in Colorado. His name is Ronald Lee White. And White was as handsome as a Hollywood movie star.
Right.
Women would drop their groceries and follow him down the street. That's how cute he was. Except the problem is, Mr. White is a sociopath. Make me angry and I will kill you. and I won't remember having done it 5 minutes later. And that's the very same thing with Mr. Lindbergh. He is a sociopath. He's not capable of any emotion except rage. He knows how to play the game with people. He knows how to make people like him, but he doesn't like them. He's not capable of liking anyone. He feels no compassion, no empathy, no love, no anything. He only feels anger when it comes up. And that's what makes someone like that so dangerous. There's absolutely no filter and absolutely no control. He does what he wants. And he makes people like him. And he did. Everybody thought Chucky was wonderful. Chucky the musician, Chucky the Bible thumper, Chucky the religious songwriter.
Oh, the charmer.
Appearing in churches. And oh boy, look at me. But just don't cross my path if I have a gun in my hand, because I'll put a bullet in you. Yeah, that's the way it is.
It's interesting. You were talking about him in the first person to begin that. So, in a way, I'm thinking that that case stayed with you.
It did, because it was so, so silly. These are teenagers. This kid was 15. The youngest kid I ever put in. He was the youngest kid ever placed in an adult prison in the history of the state of Colorado. Chucky. You know, it was just remarkable. I mean, when he signed, I think they put that in the book, I don't remember if I did, where he signed into the county jail to make you fill out this little slip. Did I put that in there?
You did.
Yeah.
Mother deceased. Yes.
Oh, shit.
Oh,
you know,
God. Right?
Yeah, oh, yeah.
A true sociopath. Very rare, but they are out there.
No, they are. Thank God. They're very rare, but they exist. And when you identify one, you have to decide what to do. We need to take you away from other humans, because you will continue to do harm, people harm. The minute the mood strikes you. He shot her the first time and knocked her down, and her response was, "Chucky, I love you." Then he shot her in the face.
Yeah, the viciousness of it is just, just chilling.
Yep.
This book will make you want to buy a carbon monoxide detector. There's a chilling story, another chilling story about a slumlord. You cuffed him extra tight. I really enjoyed reading that passage.
Yeah, that prick. You know, he had over $1 million in the bank. He's a product of the Depression and the hard times, and he wasn't going to be without money. And he was willing to sacrifice whatever was required to save $100. And so he killed people. Well, you know, when I was sitting in his kitchen, he said, "Well, I'll take my medicine." I said, "Well, there's going to be some medicine involved." You know?
You know, it's fun to hear you laugh there, Joe. It's really fun to hear you have a belly laugh. It just seems out of character. But, you know, that is your character these days. You're doing pretty good. You don't have nightmares every day. So that's really good to hear or read about.
It's better than it was. Yeah, it's better than it was. Of course it is. Yeah, but it was at the time when you're surrounded and soaked in violence. You don't have time to see the humor in anything. In fact, you lose humor. And then I began to worry. Like, I'm becoming somebody I don't particularly care for here, And you have to kind of bring yourself back to center. And then as time wears on, after you retire, and it's like they lifted an aircraft carrier off my head when I retired, it was, okay, I feel better today than I did yesterday, because I haven't seen a dead person for 24 hours, you know?
Right.
And then 48 hours and so on. In Colorado, as it's true in many states, if you die outside the presence of a doctor or outside of a custodial medical environment, the police are called to determine method and manner. How did you die, and by what manner did you die? Meaning natural causes, homicide, suicide, whatever. Okay. And the method, of course, is the manner of, is what was used to kill you, if there was an instrument involved. So method manner is what I would do. So I would go look at dead people 5 or 6 times a day, every day. Most of whom just died for various reasons. Some of whom who killed themselves, had about 12 of those a month. It's a common sport to end your life. You know, you see a lot of those people. Occasionally it would be an actual homicide. But you view death and go to death scenes constantly. I had an incident where I was in my office minding my own business, I might add, and the district attorney called me. He said, could you come over here and testify to the process of a medical legal autopsy? I said, get one of the coroners to do it. Well, they're all in court. Well, that's bullshit. They don't want to pay the fee. They charge them $500 an hour to testify in court because they're all doctors, right? So I said, well, I can't do that. I'm not a doctor. He said, just in Colorado, you can be a witness if you know more than a layperson would know about a particular subject. So he said, call down to the morgue, find out how many autopsies you've been to. Give me that number when I put you on the stand, and I'll get you qualified as an expert witness. Take you 30 minutes and you're out. I said, okay, all right, I'll do it. So I call the morgue, and there's this bubbly girl at work there. I don't know how you'd be bubbly and work in a fucking morgue, but she was. You know, and it's a Sandy, you know, I said, oh, hi, Kenda. They all know my voice, you know. I said, how many autopsies have I been to? Oh, just a minute. Yeah, I hear her striking keys. She said, 528. I almost dropped the phone. I knew it was a lot. I didn't know it was that many. And then that really upset me. I thought, good God almighty, you know. But I went over and I testified to the process and, okay, fine. But I don't miss that either, okay? I don't miss that either. You know what the cops call coroners?
No, what do they call them?
Canoe makers. Because they make you into a canoe, you know? The good old days, huh? Thank God they're over, as they say.
Yeah. Well, we're getting less violent. That's a good thing. You talk about that a lot. If there's a story that really typifies who you are, it's the story of how you found a unique weapon, the bumper jack. This was an incredible aside. It wasn't even one of the main stories, but you just talked about it very matter-of-factly in the book.
Yeah,
and absolutely Joe Kenda right there, just digging and digging and just relentless. You're relentless.
Well, that's the whole point. It's not about being smarter than everybody else. It's about never giving up.
Yeah.
You know, when you see the marks in the victim and that in Carl Taylor's head in that particular case, they measure exactly the same distance apart. This is not an object found in the natural world. This is man-made. Somebody made this. Well, who makes things? Well, manufacturers make things, you know. And one thing led to another, and I found it. You know, by doing that.
It's quite a story.
But it's really just that. It's about being determined, you know?
Really enjoying the new show, American Detective. And you get to connect with other homicide detectives all over the world. This is fascinating. And it seems like an unlimited supply of stories now. So you can basically
a new start. Unfortunately, that's true. But it's not as emotional for me this time around because I wasn't there. I didn't see it. I didn't smell it. And I didn't tell whose mother is not coming home anymore, you know, but it's still, it's the same thing. It's a professional overview of a case involving other detectives, some of whom I actually know, like Cloyd Steiger. I know that guy in Seattle. He's a good guy. Mm-hmm. And I worked a couple of cases with him. And so you meet people around the country who are paid next to nothing, who suffer the slings and arrows of the press and the public. And yet still, they work like dogs to find out who is responsible for violent crime. And they're to be admired for that, because no one else admires them. But I do, you know, and I think a lot of people probably do, don't think about it much, but I think they do admire them. But it's a exclusive club. When I used to interview people to come into homicide once I became a boss. And I'd say, okay, here's the deal. What you need to understand this before we begin. I'm going to ask you technical questions about the law. And I expect you to respond well to those. But first of all, I want you to think about this. If I put you in this unit, don't ever tell me you're hungry. Don't ever tell me you're tired. Don't tell me you have to go home and see your wife. If I thought you needed a wife, I would issue you one. You are here to do this. That's the only reason you exist. Now, if you don't think you can cut that, tell me right now and we'll part friends. And some of them did. They said, I don't think this is for me. I don't think so either. Have a nice day. go ride a motorcycle, go be a narcotics detective, you know, go do something else. You don't want to do this.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
Now, what's interesting about this book, you look at the motivation, you look at the triggers, you look at the story, why. Sex is a bit of a wild card, and this is what it psychologists have told you. This is a trigger that's hard to predict and hard to investigate. Is that the hardest to investigate, the sex trigger?
Yes, it is.
Can you touch on that?
The strongest human instinct is to survive. The second strongest instinct is the sex drive. If there's something abnormal about that sex drive, part of that equation, all bets are off on what he or she might do. And any psychiatrist will tell you that. You know, what interests me, the why question is only of importance to me when a case begins, so it can lead me to who. You know, if I know the why, I can find who. Once I have who, I no longer care about why, but in every instance, there is a trigger. There is something that sets this ball of violence in motion. And that's what's intriguing to me. How did this actually begin? You know, where did it actually start? You know, there was a famous case here recently where a guy killed a 17-year-old boy, a black kid, in, I think it was Georgia somewhere, then the South. And he said he was a security guard, which he was not. He said he was in neighborhood watch, which he sort of kind of was, but he was kind of self-appointed neighborhood watch guy. And he had been talking to the police on numerous occasions about suspicious people in his neighborhood. They were familiar with him, and they were concerned about him. They thought he was a loose cannon. And so the night that shooting occurred, he called the police and said he has seized this 17-year-old black male acting in a suspicious manner, whatever that means, in his neighborhood. The police department said, do not approach him. Do not get out of your car. We will send an officer. So what does he do next? He gets out of his car. He was told not to. He approaches the kid. He was told not to. What happens then? He shoots the kid to death. Now, how did that start? It started by willful act of his. That's what set that whole thing in motion. Not what that kid was doing. Not where he was. Nothing. Mr. Wizard in the car is why that kid's dead. That's the interesting part of what begins this. How does it start? Everything has a beginning.
Yeah. It's a very unique book and an interesting take. It's not a repeat of the first, which I do highly recommend for everybody. And you read the audiobook for the first one, too. Thanks so much, Joe Kenda. This is incredible chatting with you. The culmination of many years of hard work, I get to speak to people like you.
I'm just a guy just like you. You know, that's, I had a job. I did my job. They paid me more or less every 2 weeks, you know.
Right.
That's the way it was. I didn't care about the money. If I cared about money, I would have never been a policeman.
Yeah, I think you said you'd do it for free at one point.
Oh, I would. Yeah, I would. Yeah, I would. I still would.
Yeah. You've done a service, and I feel well more informed about the world reading your books, even though I am disturbed in it, you know, by what I've learned. But it's
one thing it makes you understand is there are certain people among us who should not be among us. They need to be in a cage. And I put a lot of them in there. Most of them are still there.
You sure did. Thanks so much again, Joe. Much obliged.
You're welcome. See you.
Cheers.
Bye-bye.
And thank you for listening to the Portland Podcast. I'm your host, Gregory Day. I produce and edit the show. If you'd like to contact me directly, you can reach me at greg@pdxpodcast.com. That was incredible. That was an amazing conversation with Joe Kenda. And I'll never forget that. It feels like I've accomplished something there. He has a certain cadence that almost sounds like he's singing a song. So we shall see you next week with a brand new episode. See you then.